This is the Living Homegrown Podcast, episode 115.
Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast, where it's all about how to live farm fresh without the farm. To help guide the way to a more flavorful and sustainable lifestyle is your host, national PBS TV producer and canning expert, Teresa Lowe.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Lowe, and this podcast is where we talk about living farm fresh without the farm. Now, that can mean preserving the harvest, small space food growing, and just taking small steps towards a more sustainable lifestyle. All the different ways that we can live closer to our food, even if we have little or no garden space at all. If you want to learn more about any of these topics or my online courses or my membership, just visit my website, livinghomegrown.com. So today's episode is all about a new book that just came out called Savory Sweet, Simple Preserves from a Northern Kitchen. And it was written by two really talented women, Beth Dooley and Meta Nielsen. Now, I had Beth come on the show today, and she's going to talk all about the book, how it came about, and the philosophies that they put into this book, which is a little bit different from a standard preserving book. And I'll go into that in a minute. But first, let me tell you a little bit about Beth. Beth Dooley has been covering the local food scene in the Northern Heartland for over 30 years. She is a wonderful writer and has co-written and written many, many cookbooks. She's the author of six specific cookbooks, including Savoring the Seasons of the Northern Heartland with Lucia Watson, which is a James Beard nominee, and Northern Heartland Kitchen, Minnesota's Bounty, the Farmer Market Cookbook, the Birchwood Cafe Cookbook, and In Winter's Kitchen, Growing Roots and Breaking Bread in the Northern Heartland. So she's written a lot of books, but she also writes for the Star Tribune and regularly appears on KARE, Channel 11 TV, and Minnesota Public Radio. She lives in Minneapolis with her husband, Kevin, and is the mother of three adult sons. And I brought on Beth to talk to us about this book and the making of the book, but also she shares a recipe that is really perfect for Thanksgiving. So it might be a recipe that you're going to want to download later and make for the Thanksgiving table because it's really delicious, made with winter squash. So if you are at all interested in anything that we talk about, the book and about Beth and Meta and the recipe, then just go to the show notes for today's episode. And that would be at livinghomegrown.com/115. And I'll have everything there for you. Now, what I wanted to tell you guys about this book is that the reason I'm saying it's a little different from the standard preserving books that we usually cover on this podcast is because you know that many of you are canners and many of you are wannabe or beginner canners. And although this book is saying that it's simple preserves, its philosophy is not to do water bath or pressure canning of any of the recipes in the book. And that's what is a little different. What Beth and Meta have done with this particular book is they created some small batch recipes that are quote unquote preserves, but they are stored in the refrigerator or the freezer, which is still a preservation method. So it is still preserving, but these recipes are not meant to be canned and put on the shelf. Of course, some of them would work for that, but they do not give you any instructions in this book for that. What this book is perfect for is for anyone who maybe is just starting out in preserving, who wants to really learn about flavor combinations. There are some fantastic recipes in here that are all done in small batches, so you're not making these huge vats of anything. But it's also a great book for when you're growing a lot of food or you shop at the farmer markets and you end up with extra, but not enough maybe to make a huge batch of something. But you have some extra cucumbers or you have some extra tomatoes and you just want to make something delicious that you could eat up in the next week or so. Well, this is the book for you. So we go all into that in the interview, but I just wanted to make that really clear because most of the preserving books that I have brought on to this show, most of the authors were talking about full-blown preserving where you're breaking out a water bath canner or a pressure canner. And in this case, you don't need either one of those items. So with that, let me bring on Beth as we dive into this delicious book called Savory Sweet, Simple Preserves from a Northern Kitchen. Hey there, Beth. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, thanks, Teresa. This will be fun.
Well, I'm really excited about this book because it came across my desk. Your publisher had sent it to me, and I was immediately taken with the beautiful photograph on the cover. But then as I started looking through the Savory Sweet book, I noticed that there were some really things that were really stand out as different in this book. So I'm so glad you were able to come on. And before we dive into the book itself, I guess I would first like to have everybody know a little bit about you. So why don't we go into that? Because you have a long history as a very well-respected food writer and an author, and you have a lot of books to your credit. So why don't you tell us all how you got started in this career?
Oh, well, I love to cook. I had a grandmother who was a fabulous cook and had a wonderful garden. And so I learned a tremendous amount from her as a child. And actually, I grew up in New Jersey. But when I moved to Minneapolis, I was just blown away by the bounty in our farmers markets and how close people lived to the land, really. I mean, we're a good-sized city, but our farms are really still pretty close to urban areas. And so the farmers markets are just booming with wonderful stuff. And having always been interested in cooking, that's kind of how I made a home when I first moved here, was by getting to know the farmers and cooking. And, you know, as soon as we started making friends, making big meals and cooking with them. And as a writer, I wanted to share the kinds of things that I'd learned from the farmers. So I began by first working, you know, in advertising, and I moved from that to writing my own things and eventually began to get published. I did have a breakthrough book with a wonderful chef named Lucia Watson, who has been nominated a number of times for a James Beard Award. She's kind of known as the Alice Waters of the Midwest. And, you know, from her, I learned a lot about how chefs approach food and how spontaneous they can be, how they really build, and especially Lucia, how she built her menus around what was coming in from local farms. And we partnered in that with my using my skills as a writer to begin to translate her food from her restaurant kitchen to the page for home cooks. And so that's kind of how I've built my career, is by sharing all of this professional advice and insights from restaurant chefs. So that's kind of how things have gone. And right now, I write a column for the Star Tribune, and I appear on a number of different radio and TV shows in Minneapolis, and I also teach cooking classes. So it's been a variety of things.
Ah, that's awesome. So that book that you did with Lucia, what was the name of that one?
That was named Savoring the Seasons of the Northern Heartland, and that actually was a James Beard Award finalist for the year it was published, which was, 26 years ago, and it's still in print.
Wow.
So it's sort of, and it kind of, you know, it was one of those books that put the Northern Heartland on the culinary map. Up until then, most people thought of Midwestern food as everything from the very top of Minnesota or Wisconsin all the way down to Kansas City. And we worked with Judith Jones, who's a legendary editor at Knopf, who passed away recently, sadly. And she was Julia Child's editor. So she really understood that our region, the Northern Heartland, is quite different from the Southern Midwest, which is really more Southern in sensibility than our food.
Ah, that's so interesting and so awesome that you got to work with her. So I guess it is very difficult for chefs many times to translate their recipes into the written word. And so that's part of what you help them do, right? For a restaurant chef. Yeah,
yes.
Because they know in their head and in their taste buds what they're trying to create. And you can translate that so that it makes our mouth water and that we want to try the recipe. And you're very good at it.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is they have available to them. Thank you. They have available to them a lot of ingredients that we home cooks don't often have. So I don't have a huge vat of veal stock, for instance, simmering on the back of my stove. So how do I, you know, replicate those kinds of flavors, or at least that sensibility, in my own kitchen?
Yes, yes. And that is so important. Otherwise, the cookbook really is not useful to us. So
right, exactly.
you bridge that gap, and that's such a wonderful, wonderful talent. Well,
thanks.
So what led you to be able to work with Mette Nielsen? Because that is who the co-author is of this book, Savory Sweet. So how did that come about? What's the story of the collaboration?
Well, Mette is a really well-known photographer in town. She's worked with Lynn Rossetto Casper, you know, who has several books out, the host of The Splendid Table. And she does a lot of commercial work for a variety of the large food companies in town. And I met her through some mutual friends and really admired her photography. She has such a wonderful sense of light and of color and of design. And she's Danish. She grew up in Copenhagen. And so she has this real sense of what it takes to be, you know, Nordic. I mean, and we live in a northern heartland where the light changes dramatically from season to season, and Mette really captures that sensibility in her photography. So I knew that I wanted to work with her, and our first opportunity was with a book that we did prior to Savory Sweet called Minnesota's Bounty, the Farmer's Market Cookbook. And she was such a brilliant photographer that she took all of those photos of the farm stands and the farmers markets without arranging any of the food and using only natural light. And so we both agreed that we wanted to work on another cookbook together because she's a fabulous cook and a wonderful gardener. And we realized that the Farmer's Market Cookbook, Minnesota's Bounty, was really the beginning for most home cooks because Mette has way more produce than she can ever use coming out of her garden. And I'm a sort of shameless Farmer's Market shopper. I always bring home way more than we can eat. And
yes.
So what do you do with it, right?
Yes.
And so we thought, well, okay, let's do a preserving book. And that gave us an opportunity to really collaborate so that we were both bringing the best of ourselves to this project.
Ah, well, I love that. And, you know, it's funny because this is such a common problem with any food gardener, but you bring up a really good point because it is a problem when you shop at farmers markets too, because everything is so beautiful and smells so wonderful. And, you know, our eyes are always bigger than our stomach and we bring home extra. And we certainly don't want that beautiful organic food to go to waste. So you guys have so many incredible recipes in here that just, they did make my mouth water, and I can't wait to try some of them. So, and we will be talking about one specific one later here in the podcast, which I'm really excited about. But
oh, good.
Yeah, it'll be good. But one of the things that really caught my eye about the book that made it so different was that although you're talking about making preserves, you actually are not talking about processing them in a water bath or a pressure canner. So in other words, the preserves are made to be eaten in the fresh state, either in the refrigerator or in the freezer. So what made you guys decide to go that route?
Well, there are a couple of things that go on. The first thing is that we knew that most of our readers, like us, have smaller kitchens. I don't have the capacity to put up 20 pounds of or 40 pounds of tomatoes and spend all day on a sweltering August day to do that, even if I could. And there's really no need to because we have refrigerators and we've got freezers. So what kinds of preserves am I really going to make realistically? They'll be small batches, they'll be quicker. And then once we began to dig into this whole process, we realized too that water bathing a product cooks it another 20 or even 30 minutes. And by using smaller quantities and shorter cooking times, we ended up with a much fresher tasting product than if you then put it in a jar and cooked it again for another 20 minutes. So our preserves are really vibrant and they retain their fresher textures and their more lively flavors. It is really possible to make these smaller batch preserves. All of ours practically are made in a 10-inch skillet. And the reason for doing that is by using a wider cooking surface, you're cooking the food again. It cooks quickly. It cooks in a shorter period of time. And you're able to do things in 10, 15, 20 minutes at the max. So it's a nice way. It's really more nimble. It's a little more flexible way to preserve things. And by making these jars in smaller batches, you can keep them in the refrigerator and use them up really quickly. So if somebody drops by for a glass of wine or something at the last minute, you just put out a cheese plate and you have a nice little compote there that they can have with the cheese, or you're in a hurry and you're making a quick weeknight dinner and all you need to do is saute a chicken breast or throw something on the grill, and you have, you know, a couple of different condiments that turn that very simple, ordinary dinner into something that feels a little more special.
Yes. Well, so you definitely are hitting a different market by doing the no water bath and the no pressure canning. So I find with my audience that it definitely breaks into two groups. There are the people who do want to do the water bath canning and the pressure canning, and a lot of them live out in the country or, you know, may have times where their refrigerators or freezers wouldn't be workable. They are trying to stock up. And then there's the other side, which is more of the foodie type who just wants to experiment with these recipes. And that's really what I found your book spoke to, is the person who maybe wants to try some of these things, but doesn't want to make 8, 10, 12 jars of whatever it is. Because unless you're doing Christmas, that's not really something that you will eat up in a fresh state. So that's why it was so great when I saw that all of the batches that were in here are really small batches. And that makes it free for us to experiment with all of these. And we don't have a big investment of time or in money, but it does give us a way to use up this produce, which is so fantastic.
Right. That's exactly right. And for someone who really does want to get into canning eventually, say someone who's interested in canning and is maybe a little afraid to make that kind of investment in time or equipment and stuff, you could call this book a gateway book. So you can get started with our book and then go on. And I think that was the other thing. When we began to research the topic, we realized there are some really wonderful books out there on large batch preserving that are great. So we thought this might sort of bridge that gap between fresh and, you know, stock your whole cupboard kind of preserving.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially if, you know, you just wanted to try a pickle, for example, you have some really excellent recipes in here that are so creative and use spices in different ways. And a pickle is something that, you know, it's very, very easy to transition that pickle into something that you would make and preserve for a longer period of time. So I loved that. I definitely think it could be a gateway. This could be a way for people to try to do preserving if they don't want to do the canning part. And then, yes, it's definitely the next step is not that far. It's not that far-fetched to do it. One of the other things that I loved about the book was that your decision to make it mostly low sugar or no sugar. And I know that was to let the flavor come out. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that was really intentional, because when we looked at some of the other recipes, we came about a lot of the older recipes, you know, sugar can also be a preservative. And so if you're not water bathing and intending to keep these foods for a long time, you can cut way back on the sugar and just, again, store them in the refrigerator or the freezer. And that, too, allows the fresh flavors of these foods to shine through, you know, and not mask the brightness of them. And so we use a lot of hot and sweet. We use a lot, or hot and tangy as well, or sweet and tangy. So a lot of the flavors contrast in order to bring that sort of sharpness and a different sensibility. And in Nordic tradition, those sweet, savory flavors are used both at the beginning of the meal, during a meal, and at the end of the meal. So our intent was that, say, the balsamic strawberry marmalade, for instance, could be used with a cheese plate. It could be used to baste a chicken breast or whisked into a vinaigrette, or is also delicious drizzled over some vanilla ice cream or even for breakfast with a scone. So again, we were thinking that people want to expand and broaden the way they think about preserves and just play with them a little bit.
Ah, you're making my mouth water now. That sounds so good. So good. Well, when you guys were collaborating on this book, did you both come together and develop the recipes, or was it more one person handled one section? How did you guys work that out?
We decided to follow the organizational structure of the Farmers Market Cookbook, Minnesota's Bounty, which was to come up with recipes item by item. The reason being, most preserving books are organized by type of preserve. So if you flip through a preserving book, for instance, or a canning book, they are organized according to, say, jams and jellies or pickles and preserves, or so the chapters go that way. But we realized in our case that when we're going to make a preserve, it's because we have a lot of a particular, you know, fruit or vegetable. And so we don't want to have to thumb through all of the recipes in the pickle chapter, for instance, to find the one we want for cucumbers. So we organized it according to produce item. And then we just sat down and started brainstorming. It's like, okay, what are we going to do with eggplant? And all of the produce in the book is all local produce. It's all things that you can find at our farmers markets and probably at most farmers markets around the country. There will be things that are particular to, say, the Deep South that we don't grow here. So we didn't include those, but we did focus on things that our growers are doing, which the area here has really expanded quite a lot. So you can find jicama in our area. You can find peanuts in our area. There are all kinds of things that grow here that didn't used to before. And that, a lot of that has to do with the different immigrants that have settled here and brought their foods with them.
Ah, well, I did notice that you had organized the book that way, which was so nice, because I know exactly what you're talking about. I'll end up with, you know, let's say a flat of peaches, and I have to go back to the index of a regular canning book and look up all the different recipes for peaches to try and find which one I want to make. And you have this organized, you know, like all the cucumber recipes are together and all the onion recipes are together. So it was really nice. I thought that was great.
Well, yeah, thanks.
Now, there was one thing that I saw in there that I thought was such a clever little trick, and it was, you called it the dipstick method.
That was born of both of us have always been frustrated when you read a recipe and it says reduce by half. Well, what does that really mean? Because it's going to be different pot per pot, so it's going to depend on how much liquid the tomatoes have in them, for instance, or, you know, whether or not you're actually using the 10-inch skillet or something else. And so instead, you take a wooden spoon and you mark it with a pencil, dip the wooden spoon into the, dip the end of the wooden spoon, the handle of the wooden spoon into whatever you're making, and you know what that level is. And then you can tell as it reduces when you dip it again whether or not it's gone down by half.
I know. I thought that was so good. I was like, why didn't I ever think of that? When I saw that in the book, I'm like, okay, I got to make you talk about that, because I was like, that, you know, it's just brilliant. And it was something I had never done. I'm always trying to guesstimate, you know, based on, and it's hard because you kind of forget where you started and you can't.
Right.
So that was very good. Love that. That's a really good handy trick there. So
well, I'm a very distracted cook too.
Yeah.
So I have to keep things really interesting.
Yeah, it's good. Well, okay. So when you guys were working on this book and you were coming up with all your recipes, or on any of the books that you've worked on, what do you find to be your favorite part of the process?
You know, I think for me, it's working in the studio with Meta, because that's usually the final run of a recipe. We'll both test something several times in our own kitchen and we'll give it to friends and things. But when you see things finally come together under the camera and you've followed the recipe exactly as it's written and it turns out beautifully, it's like, yeah, we nailed it. That's my favorite part. Yeah.
Success.
Yeah. Exactly.
Perfect.
And it's a good fail-safe too, because when you go to make it And if it doesn't look the way you expect it's going to, or it's not all that attractive, or maybe it needs a little more spice, or maybe you need to add something for color, then that allows us the opportunity to write that in at the time.
Yeah, it's your like last chance to kind of tweak it before it goes out the door.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, so then what's your least favorite part of doing the whole cookbook process?
You know, that's another really good question. I think I'm always a little concerned around quantities because we're dealing with fresh produce. And so I can't tell you exactly how ripe the apples you're working with are, or whether or not the tomatoes you're looking at are the same size as my tomatoes. And so we tried to be as careful as we could by working with pounds and by working with cups. So we tried to include as many measurements as we possibly could so that people would have an idea of what they were really working with and what to expect. But that's always, that's sort of the fussy part. And I always just am a little worried that things work out as well in somebody else's kitchen as they have in mine. So we're very careful with those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's the tricky part, isn't it? Everybody has a different stove. The ripeness makes a big difference in how much water content, which will affect how long it really takes to cook. So when you say, cook 10 minutes, it might be different for someone else.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And I also think, the one thing I learned from Judith Jones, who, was the editor in our first cookbook, is she used to sort of chide me and she'd say, "You're not writing for the Chamber of Commerce. It has to have a voice. It has to sound as though you're standing next to someone and explaining how to do something." So you're always trying to strike that balance between being too wordy and too descriptive and being, clear enough that somebody understands what the texture of something is going to be or what the scent of something is going to be, those kinds of things.
Well, I have to say you've definitely nailed it because you do an excellent job of that. There are very few books that come across my desk that I would sit up in bed and read like a novel, but yours was one of them.
And thank you. That means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Because when a cookbook can really make you in your mind's eye taste and see it without ever actually making it, you've done an excellent job. And that is what this book did. And there were so many really creative uses of flavorings that's why I had to have you on. I was really excited.
Thank you.
Sure. And speaking of that, there's one recipe that I would love to have you kind of walk the audience through. It was your sweet pickled winter squash that was in the book. It was such a timely thing for this time of year because you mentioned in the book that it would be really good as a condiment for the Thanksgiving turkey.
Yes, exactly. And it's really a fun recipe. We discovered it, in researching this book and looking for new ideas. We went back through a lot of the older books because people were doing some really interesting things preserving years and years ago. And mind you that back then people didn't have access to fruit the way we do all season long. So they had run out of oranges or they'd run out or couldn't get oranges. They were too expensive, or maybe the apples had run out. And so they wanted something to pickle that might be savory and sweet. And they had a lot of squash. So they pickled squash and we tried it. And it is really delicious. It's remarkable because in making this sweet pickle, you don't really cook the squash for that long a period of time. So it retains some of its crunch. And yet, as you know, squash is just naturally sweet. So this ends up being a nice pickle that you can use as a condiment with your turkey, or you can put on your turkey sandwich the next day, or you can give away during the holidays to friends. And it just uses apple cider and water and lime juice and lime zest and red pepper flakes, a little bit of sugar, not a whole lot, butternut squash in our case, because I think butternut is the easiest to peel when it's fresh. I think it's more difficult to work with, say, an acorn squash or a delicata squash, which, yes, they have thin skin, but they're ridged. So the butternut has that nice smooth skin.
Do you use like a potato peeler when you peel it?
You can use a potato peeler, but I've had more success with just a paring knife.
Okay.
I just use a paring knife. Yeah. And, the squashes are so big that you're not, even if you take off more skin than you intend, mm-hmm. it's not that big a deal. And then a lot of ginger, which seems to work really nicely with that squash flavor. And We use allspice and then some black peppercorns. And the process is so simple because you're making the brine first by boiling all of the brine ingredients together and then allowing them to macerate. You add this, you cut the squash into sort of finger-sized pieces and you put them in a bowl. You pour the hot brine over them and you allow that squash to macerate or absorb those flavors overnight, or 8 hours minimum, and then you drain that off and put it in a saute pan, and then add more flavors into it, and you simmer it for just about 30 minutes, and you have this nice, really wonderful pickle that's ready to jar. And in some cases, I've just put the entire thing in a bowl in the, let it cool, put it in a bowl in the refrigerator. If you don't want to, you know, put it in individual jars because you might want to use it all up through the week, and you can do that too.
So when you pour the liquid back into a saucepan to heat it up, are you putting also the squash in there too? So you're cooking the squash and the brine together?
Correct. You're cooking it a little bit again. After it's macerated, you're cooking it again.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that is pretty easy. So you let it soak. And then the next day, you're just heating it up and cooking the squash just a little bit in that brine.
Correct.
And then you can store the whole thing in the refrigerator. And it would probably last like a week or two. You'd probably eat it before then.
It's usually gone by then. But actually, you know, we recommend, I mean, to be on the safe side, you'd say maybe 5 days to a week. But to be honest, I've had that in the back of the refrigerator for up to 2 weeks, and it's tasted great.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at the recipe now, and it has a cup of vinegar in it and a cup of water, which is definitely a solid pickle, and that vinegar will keep it very preserved. So I wouldn't have any qualms about that at all. And the ginger in there would just taste fantastic. So this sounds really good. So then when you serve it, you would just kind of serve it as a side with the squash, is it basically cubed or is it like fingered?
No, you use it as fingers. So you'd use it like a dill pickle, for instance, just a pickle. So you can just pick it up with your fingers and eat it. Okay. You could also, if you wanted to have it more as a relish, you could chop it up and put it in a little relish bowl and people could have it that way. The other thing you could do for, say, a turkey sandwich, if you wanted to, is take those fingers, chop them up and stir them into mayonnaise, if you wanted to do that.
Oh, yum.
Or you,
that sounds so good.
Yeah. Or you, don't get me going. And throw them into, say, a wild rice salad with some turkey, that kind of thing.
Yes. Oh, that sounds really good. And so also in the book, though, you say that if you wanted to, you could put them into jars, into clean canning jars with the lid. And you like people to leave a good head space because if it's going to freeze, the liquid will expand, and that you could put it in the freezer if you wanted to.
Yes, for sure. And most of our preserves freeze beautifully. I mean, it's really a nice way to keep them.
Yes. Well, because you do a short cooking process, you're cooking it long enough to kill the enzymes on it that would cause any softening in the freezer. So the fact that it's gone through that, it's perfectly fine for freezing and will last a good long time if someone doesn't want to keep it in their refrigerator or they want to make it ahead for Thanksgiving. They could do
that too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
Fantastic. Well, Beth, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and sharing all this information about your book. It just is very mouthwatering to talk to you. I so appreciate you taking the time out of your day to be with us and share about your book, Savory Sweet. It's really exciting.
Oh, thank you, Teresa. It's been really a pleasure. Thanks so much.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Beth Dooley of Savory Sweet, Simple Preserves from a Northern Kitchen. Now remember that everything that we talked about on the episode, including the full recipe in PDF format, is going to be in the show notes for today's episode. And to get to the show notes, you just go to livinghomegrown.com/115. I'll have everything there for you. Thank you so much for joining me here today. I know you're super busy, and I really appreciate that you took time out of your busy day to listen to this podcast. So until next time, just live a little more local, seasonal, and homegrown. Take care, everybody.
That's all for this episode of the Living Homegrown Podcast. Visit livinghomegrown.com to download Teresa's free canning resource guide and find more tips on how to live farm fresh without the farm. Be sure to join Teresa Lowe next time on the Living Homegrown Podcast.